This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
All right. If you have checked out the new Netflix doc about Samuel Bateman and the FDLS cult, you're in for a good episode. Samuel Bateman was borrowing $20 originally, sleeping on couches. 3 years later, fathers were handing him their 9-year-old daughters, and businessmen were buying him Bentleys. The Netflix doc, Trust Me, The False Prophet, shows you what he built. It doesn't show you how the specific moves a man with nothing used to make 50 people hand over everything. What did he see in them that we couldn't see in themselves, that they couldn't see in themselves? That's the question that we are asking today as we get into that doc and the thinking of Bateman and the thinking of the FLDS members and how people get there. I think that's a big question so many have is, how did you even get here? How did you find yourself falling into this world this hard? Joining Robin Dreek and myself to discuss, Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author. Nightbird is her book. She is someone who has survived this type of extreme religiosity and is here to talk about it. And you have helped countless people since with your own story. Siobhan, let's start with the doc here. You watch the doc. You see the parents educated enough to hold jobs, run businesses, raise families. They seem like fairly normal folks. And so you start talking about religion and giving their children to some guy that kind of came out of the woodwork, not at gunpoint, voluntarily. He's the prophet. What is it about someone like Bateman? What is it that he operates under that makes otherwise functional people do something as horrific as literally handing over their daughters to him?
Yeah. This would not be a man. I don't think many of us would look at him and say, "I want him as my baby daddy." All appearances, somebody that could have been framed a loser. But I think it was when he stepped into this, there was this cohesive group. They had lost contact for the most part with Warren Jeffs, their prophet. They came in with tremendous vulnerabilities and a lot of thinking errors and distorted belief systems. These were people who were needing a shepherd. They were needing guidance. And I didn't get the impression that Sam was a particularly bright person, but he was a highly manipulative person. And manipulative people are dangerous, even when they're not really bright. You know, yeah. When they're super bright, they run for office and get elected to high office just on virtue of being manipulative. But yeah, he knew how to use love bombing. He knew how to do this gradual takeover of their minds to position himself as a prophet, which essentially, in the way this worked, he was their God. And mm-hmm. they were trained that these young women, everything was about obedience. And this is what spirituality meant to them. You stay sweet, you stay subservient, you learn not to think, and you obey. And that was the way to heaven. And it just was this combination of people in this vulnerable state without a leader, and this guy just swooped in with the garbage.
You know, Siobhan, I'm curious, and I know we're going to get to this and talking about the amazing documentarian, Catherine, not Catherine, is it Catherine on this? We'll get to her. But what I'm really curious at the very onset of this, what really struck me, and I'm curious what you think it was, because from my take, it looked like when Samuel came in, he targeted one of the guys first, one of the higher ups. Mm-hmm. And it sounded like he did something that solved some sort of life crisis for him, which is what you do when you're recruiting, aspire recruiting anyone. You bring in resources that are going to solve some critical life challenge. And then when you have the behaviors of trust, you might have a relationship kind of thing. But what do you think it was that he solved or was able to make this attachment, to have this loyalty to this one of these elders, we'll just call him elders, sort of point mm-hmm. of this, mm-hmm. early on, that enabled him to kind of weave his way to get this guy to eventually give up his underage daughters?
His daughters, yeah. Yeah, I would love to know the conversations that they had, because we really didn't get into that aspect of it, which leaves us curious. But definitely he could tune in on what people needed to hear. And I believe Warren Jeffs had told them all, you can't have sex anymore. You can't have babies anymore.
You can't get married.
Unless you have permission.
Warren was the only one who could perform the marriages. And then once he got arrested, no one was allowed. Because there's a documentary prior to this about Warren Jeffs that goes deeply into that. It's kind of like the part two to it almost. So nobody was getting married in Short Creek for a long time. And then suddenly somebody was married, and they were married to Bateman. And then everybody was kind of like, ooh, I miss Skittles too. Maybe we can do kind of something like this. And then everybody was kind of like, he must be the new prophet.
Right.
The power of that suggestion there was quite amazing. That's what gets me about this guy. And you said it early. It doesn't take someone to be super intelligent to be cunning or manipulative to be effective. I think that's what is shocking to a lot of people. In my mind, I don't know. For those of us who don't practice, you know, active manipulation on large populations of people, which is most of us, I think in my mind, I always think, well, you got to be like, if you're going to do that, you got to like be really smart and really with it. No, you just have to believe your own shit. Yeah. You just have to believe that you are a prophet. And if you just basically play a role, and it's a very simple, stupid role. Like if this guy threw out a YouTube channel, people would be like, what the hell is wrong with him? Like, this is a crazy man. But if you do it to the right people in the right way, and you're kind about it, and, you know, at least initially, and you're loving about it, and you speak their language, and the language of basically eternal damnation or salvation, and I happen to be the only one who knows which way to go, you can get a lot of people.
Yeah, I saw echoes of Chad Daybell in him.
Yeah,
the 100%. profound narcissism, the manipulation, and to some degree, delusional with, you know, probably he would be diagnosed with a delusional disorder, you know, not really psychotic, but you've got this one set belief, which you're not going to let go of. Mm-hmm. And he really had no capacity to see himself as the rest of the world would look at this, because he believed he was this terrific. And he believed he, and probably still does, believes he is a prophet, which basically means every word of his out of his mouth is coming from Heavenly Father. And these poor young women were so brainwashed into this, no capacity to think for themselves. It's just,
I start out blaming the guys on this. You know, so here's a guy that comes into this pre-arranged cult of FDLS with $20 in his pocket because he's a complete failure, just like Chad Daybell was. I mean, Chad Daybell couldn't do anything, so he actually had to resort to the only income he could get was killing people and getting their life insurance policies, right? This guy is exactly the same, and yet it's astounding me that he was able to he can't manipulate his way through life to get more than $20, but he can come in and completely manipulate the first guy who's a successful businessman. Because so here's a guy that was given Bentleys, had all this money, and his flock was 20 to 30 people, 50 at its most. And so this wasn't big, but these were wealthy enough people to give it all to him through this manipulation, yet he couldn't manipulate his own world outside of this. I mean, it's just profound. And like you said, you just look at this guy, you listen to this guy, and he believed his own crap. I mean, right into the Queen of England, doing a music video for her. What the hell?
I love it. And the fact that Christine during the whole thing's like, let's make the
Christine
music video.
Catherine, right?
Let's make it work. And to go along with it, like, Okay, like that's some very interesting embedded reporting that we saw.
She was a genius. She was a sheer genius. And we'll talk about her more later, but when it comes to FBI undercover work, I've never seen any, and she wasn't even working on behalf of the FBI at that time. I've never seen anyone more effective at what they needed to do than her. She intuitively knew exactly what to do.
I was just going to say that. Oh, yeah.
Genius, sheer genius.
She went on instinct, and she really knew how to feed his narcissism. And her husband did the same thing too.
Yeah.
They both fed his narcissism. And if you get a narcissist that's not terribly bright and you feed their narcissism in that way, you can manipulate them to really show their true colors.
And that's the way she did it. You know, just coming in and saying, I want to do this documentary on you. And just like you, Siobhan, she had reps in this world because she had been abused by this world. So she knew how to communicate. But at the same time, though, typically, people that are high-level manipulators can pick up on people trying to take advantage of them pretty cleanly, you know, like the Samuel guy. Yet she was so good at not giving any leakage whatsoever to tip him off of the fact that she's there to save the girls, 100%. That's her entire mission. And yet that compassion, that empathy towards them was extremely real and present and in the moment. Yet she was able to look exactly the same to him. Mm-hmm. That's what blew my mind. That's where her genius was, pure genius. What a human being.
She really did that heart-to-heart connection. They could feel that she cared about them, and she cared about the babies. She cared about the all the women. And people who are deprived, and these folks were certainly deprived in so many ways, they're drawn to that. Yeah. And you don't ever win them over by coming in and criticizing their beliefs.
Right.
But you come in with making that heart connection. And she did it.
Yeah, she really did.
When you have high-level manipulators like this, or when you have high-level manipulators, ones that are able to manipulate people, knowing that they're manipulating people, knowing that if I pull this lever here, I'm going to get this result and this sort of complicity with people. I mean, for example, Bateman made the followers confess their sins publicly. I mean, this is something that a lot of cults do. Scientology does it through, through the, what is it called? Where you hold in the little cans, basically, and then you confess your things, and then they write it all down, and then they use it against you if you ever try to like go against them. I mean, so many do that. Confess your sins to me. Confess your sins to this human being, and I shall supposedly just, you know, it's supposed to be your respite, your way of letting it out, and then this other person hears them, and then you're forgiven. It should never then be used over you like a lever, but if you're going to be manipulative, you use it like a lever and hold it over people. And this is one of the things that Bateman did to his followers. There's ones that are doing that with intent, knowing if I get this information, I can use it over them. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if Bateman is one of those, or if in so many of these cases, they're not looking at that as a manipulation lever. It's just how things function. It's just, this is the information I have. This is what happens. I am the leader. I'm the one in control. I am hearing from God. And this is just how things function. They're not looking at it as manipulation. Do you think Bateman looked at any of this as manipulation? Do you think Bateman's just believing his own thing and people are flocking to him because they want to believe in something, and nobody is literally sitting here in the corner conniving, going, how am I going to control these people? It just works when everybody believes the same delusion and people subscribe to a mentally ill person.
Mm-hmm. I think he did, and this was probably his Machiavellian instincts, right? How do I maneuver here and get power? Because he wanted to keep his thumb on everything. And by getting people to confess their failings, their, you know, again, their vulnerable areas, it gave him a sense of power because he saw himself in this godlike position. And, you know, it put him one above them. And certainly if someone had tried to break off, I don't doubt that he would have used what he knew about them to control them. So another part of coercive control.
It definitely, as time went on through the special, as the years progressed, it looked as though he truly believed the crap coming out of his mouth. I mean, Do you think he actually believed it coming out of his mouth when he went in, or was that a progression from, hey, maybe I can try this, and then all of a sudden, oh yeah, I am this?
It would be good to know and ask him, at what point did you become aware that you were a prophet? And it was probably at some point he had woke up with an epiphany, hey, I can do this, and started testing it out. And then it gradually, it reinforced him because he was pulling it off. But yeah, when he had them, this video that he wanted taken of him out riding the motorcycle. And as they said, he wasn't a very good motorcycle rider, but I want to see myself on the motorcycle. I want music videos of me. Here's where Queen Elizabeth is going to sit after, you know, she's my next wife. I mean, no intelligent person, they would realize when they're taking it too far and they're getting bizarre out there. And yeah, I think that says a lot about his mental state.
I mean, how does someone like that, I'm sorry, Tony, how does someone like that, that sees Warren Jeffs behind bars for taking advantage of all these underage wives he had, think it's actually a great idea to repeat it again and not get caught?
Mm-hmm. Did not learn from lessons. Clearly,
no.
This is a guy who did not connect the dots well, and this grandiosity that he displayed was so profound, he thought he was untouchable.
But there is a moment in the doc where Christine says, let's take some photos of you with the young girls. And he has enough sense to say, oh, that's how they took Warren Jeffs down. We better
exactly.
not do that.
Yeah.
So I mean, that I found striking. That made me go, oh, he is aware of what's going on. Because if he was so delusionally aware and he thought, you know, God's master plan is at work right now and God's going to protect us from everything, I don't think he'd be saying, well, that's how they took Warren Jeffs down. I think he'd be like, of course, this is what we want to share this with the world. But at the end, is this a prime example of how narcissism wins every time? Not the narcissist. But anyone who practices, it's the narcissism like a disease that takes him down with the videos, the music videos, the let's have a camera crew follow me around as I do virtually everything Warren Jeffs did. And then that sort of exposure, is this just that where it's like, you don't really need to do much, just let him be in his environment and it will destroy. He will destroy himself in time.
Yeah, yeah. I think he had a little bit of savvy about that because that was something that was very concrete that obviously he stuck with that one, you know, keep the little girls out of the wedding poses here. But he sure let a lot of people know that these were his wives going down to 9 years old. And I mean, when it got into the sexual behavior, it was just sickening.
And that's where I am so, again, we keep harping on how amazing Christine was. What do you think she did that was able to engender trust with him to allow him to put everything on video as a documentary after an organization had been taken down by, and as close as it was under Warren Jeffs, and they were still taken down, yet this idiot, thankfully he's an idiot, allowed Christine in a documentary who's not part of the FLDS to come in and video. What do you think was she doing that could actually feed so heavily into that narcissism without him being skeptical of entrapment?
Compliments, feeding his ego consistently over and over, talking about how much she loved them all. And I think when it came to the women and the children, that was very genuine on her part.
100%.
It certainly felt that way. And I'm not completely sure how much time it took. I think it said in the beginning people were skeptical of her.
Sure.
But over time, they came to believe her. And that was that deep ability she had to role play a very heart-to-heart connection and to truly admire him. There was a lot in the video where she was making very admiring comments of him. And his ego just swelled up.
Yeah, you just feed that ego, and it's amazing. It's amazing what how delicious that must taste to some people.
Exactly.
That they're able to just be like, okay, wherever you lead me, it's going to be great.
Yeah.
For someone who is, you know, so powerfully manipulative, how easy one can pull that over their own eyes if you know what levers to pull.
Yeah.
Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube about this segment. Siobhan's book, Nightbird, available wherever you get books. Go and check that out. And
please
we'll
get
that
book. It'll serve you or someone you know in your life very, very well. It's a fantastic quick read. Really good.
Your thoughts in the comments on Substack and YouTube, and press subscribe. We're talking about cults. We're talking about Sam Bateman. We're talking about the Netflix doc that just dropped about exactly this, about the FLDS and Samuel Bateman. The doc shows you the trailer, the arrests, the courtroom. It can show you what was happening inside the heads of the people that were living it. Women who smiled on camera while their lives were being dismantled. Children who wrote the truth in journals but couldn't say it out loud to a single adult. Fathers who believed handing over a 9-year-old was an act of love. This conversation is about the damage that no sentence to Samuel Bateman can fix. With us, Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author of the book Nightbird, available wherever you get books. Highly recommended. She herself is a survivor of extreme religious control. Siobhan, as we dive into this, one of the biggest things to me, we saw the wives that were in this, but even more compelling and more disturbing to me were these fathers, these people who were like successful business people, people who had like had enough money to buy somebody a Bentley. You know, that's expensive. That's something that, you know, just like, well, let me, it's not like I'm buying you a Geo Metro because you're helping take the kids to school or something. Mm-hmm. It's a Bentley. And even worse than that, beyond physical gifts, giving the ultimate gift, their daughters, mm-hmm. to this man, mm-hmm. because they were convinced that he was the prophet. They're not being manipulated in any sort of S way in a bedroom. This is just man to man talking, if you will. What? Give me your thoughts on this, because that was a unique angle to this story, and one that we don't usually see typically in a lot of cults. It's typically leader and his wives.
Right, right. What it spoke to me about is the insidious nature of, you know, sometimes we use the word patriarchy all over the place, but this I think is a perfect example of the patriarchy, where men ruled women. Women were not looked at as people. They were looked at objects to be used, including their daughters. And how can this use of women, having as many wives as you can afford, apparently, and then basically giving your daughters away as if they're cattle, and that there was no internal moral structure, that this is wrong. And I think that's one of the most disturbing things about cults, is that women, particularly these fundamentalist religious cults, women are not real people. They're not real people. They're objects to be used. And that's how I saw that.
This is the complete underlining bedrock of every single cult we study, whether it's IBLP, whether it's FLDS. It is how you're going to subjugate women. Mm-hmm. And it blows my mind that they still don't recognize it in there. And which was, to Tony's point, it's so revolting and compelling watching fathers that look like they have emotion about their children willingly hand them over like the commodity that they were told they were. With their daughter, I mean, and going back to the precursor to this, and Warren Jeffs one, where they get a little more granular than they even did on this one, the Netflix doc, it's just abhorrent. You can't even imagine this is happening outside of, mm-hmm. You know, 500 BC in Greece or mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. It just blows your mind how I mean, talk about that dichotomy, that how can someone feel that it's wrong, like it looked like they did, and even the mothers, especially the mothers, and yet they mm-hmm. still did it.
Mm-hmm.
especially when it's such a, it's not like you had the social proof of hundreds of people or thousands, like in the Warren Jeffs case. We're talking 20 to 30.
Mm-hmm.
It's mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm. It is mind-blowing, and it's really hard for those of us who don't think that way to understand how can you devalue and debase your wives and your daughters in this way. It's a different mindset, and it does feel like something that goes back hundreds of years, you know, in humanity, in human society, where women, I mean, women were burned as witches if, you know, the community didn't like them, and daughters were sold. I mean, there are still parts of the world where women are sold, or women who displease their parents are murdered. You know, I'm thinking of countries like India where those things still happen. Yeah. And it shows how much our culture, of course, there are problems with America. We can all list those. We're not perfect. But women are people here, you know, in normal society, we recognize that. And we're not treated as animals. We should not be treated as animals. And this is just in so many ways a backwards, you know, society. They have their own society. And women and girls are looked at in a very different way.
It came down to numbers. I mean, FLDS's belief system was that the only way to get into heaven is the more wives you have. You know, according to Warren Jeffs, you needed at least three, and only he could assign you that. And so the second question I have to this is, so they selectively choose things from the Bible to support what they want to do, yet it's countered by other things about in the Bible, like Amy Duggar King, who's she does an amazing job at the very beginning of her book talking about the counters inside the Bible to all the things that she was talking learned about IBLP. Are they precluded from reading the Bible from themselves and seeing these counters? Or are they not curious about, you know, hey, you say this, but it actually doesn't mean it here? I mean, where's the disconnect? How come they can't reason for themselves that this is wrong?
There is no reasoning for themselves that goes on. In fact, reasoning is being disobedient. You're not supposed to ask questions. You don't object. You don't raise inconsistencies, because the Bible, there are so many distinctly different parts of the Bible, Old Testament from New Testament, ways that sin is described, ways that salvation is described. And it's kind of all over the place. And people, if they have an agenda, they can pick out the portions that they want. And that's what they hone in on. If it's okay, I want to read just a tiny bit from my book about what I wrote about thinking.
Yeah. This is her book, by the way.
Yeah. And this is the end of my prologue. Put my reading glasses on. In church, I learned that there was no need to think, no need to think about the future. Just follow the blood on the tracks and trust God, who controls all things, even the temperature of the water that comes out of my comes out of the shower on my head. God will take care of my life. No planning required, no thought required. Just pray. Don't feel, don't think, just pray. Keep praying. Keep praying. Pray harder. Pray until you're out of breath. And that's really the mindset. That was my mindset at 13, 14, 15 years old. You are discouraged from thinking because that's how the devil can get in. So you don't point out the discrepancies. You don't ask, you know, you don't even ask the pastor, well, how does that verse disagree with that verse? And how do I tie this together? You just don't do that because that's how the devil gets in your head. And when that pastor speaks, he is the voice of God. And so when you hear that enough and you grow up in that, you know, I remember going around and of course I was a thinker, doubts would creep in and I would just have to shut it down cognitively. And I would just have to go back and repeat a Bible verse in my head all the time.
Do cults like this, they in even lesser organizations that aren't to the level of cult, but are controlling groups of people, There's a term that gets thrown around. It's a common term, and it sounds so simple. It almost sounds like, to some folks, like a warm cup of coffee, and a scone, maybe a croissant on a nice porch where everybody's chatting. Bible study. That's the term. Bible study. And when you say it like that, like, we're going to get together for a Bible study, it makes you think you're like having some sort of conversation where people are debating the Bible, people are working it down and like trying to understand it better. But in reality, and maybe there are some Bible studies like that. There are some groups and some versions of religious interpretation that do exactly that, and good for them. But a lot of them, it ain't a study. Mm-mm. It's a lecture.
It's someone
telling you, if you have any question, you got a question about the great, I'm going to tell you how to interpret it.
Right.
And I think that might also answer some of your question there, Robin, too. How do they get there? Because if they do have a question, they don't sit there and read the Bible. They bring their concern to the leader, and the leader goes, oh, well, here's the interpretation of it. Mm-hmm. And their interpretation, well, there's your answer. Now I know. Because the leader told me this is how it should be interpreted, and he's wiser than me. He studied this far more than I have. So, of course, I'm going to believe mm-hmm. him. Mm-hmm. And then that's how you can get bastardization of the Bible through a human being. And then many people start believing it.
Right. Right.
It's Jim Bob.
Yeah. Anybody. I mean, anybody that's going to take that role and not truly, you know, jump in and allow people to learn and to make their own decisions and to come to their own conclusions.
You know, and Tony, I know, I don't mean to, it's not going off track. It's kind of related, hopefully. Yeah. I remember after 9/11 and working in New York City, and I'd worked counterintelligence my career, recruiting spies, and Russia was my focus. But after 9/11, we shifted to the Middle East for a large period of time because we needed sources there. And I even speak about him in my book, Sizing People mm-hmm. Up. His name in the book is Anon. I remember talking to Anon after he came on board with helping us. I said, how is it that these people from your country have no problem doing this, like these suicide missions and you know, killing other people in the name of their God, of Allah? And he goes, well, that's easy. He goes, they don't know better. And I said, what do you mean they don't know any better? He goes, well, when they go, again, in these situations, they get radicalized or the fundamental extremists because they don't have the capability of reading the Quran for themselves. Mm-hmm. And so it's told to them through the mullah what is, and if they question it, it's against God, it's against Allah. Mm-hmm. And so, and mm-hmm. when you combine that with nothing else to lose, why wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. So yeah. Again, when you control the information and you don't allow discernment, if you don't allow someone to be curious about interrogating that information themselves or have questions, you know, to Siobhan's point, this is the crazy that can happen.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so true. It's true in most religions that when it comes down to what you've taken in. I mean, it's all you know. I mean, it's applicable outside of religion. No matter, you only know what you know. And mm-hmm. and if what you know is that the most important thing ever is what happens when you're dead, not actually what happens mm-hmm. while you're alive, and the goal is just simply servicing your death, you'll do anything. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems to be the key to all of this. If you can make the most important thing to you, your death, and what happens on the other side, and everything is servicing that, then nothing what happens over here really matters. Because at the end of the day, it's all wiped clean. Whatever, you're good. Mm-hmm. And death is the ultimate thing. Which I mean, it's insane. But it seems to be what a majority of civilization has subscribed to for pretty much ever.
isn't it kind of crazy and interesting in a tragic, horrific way that the path to salvation in each one of these types of extremist cults is a subjugation of women?
Yes.
Every
yes.
single one of
yes.
them.
Yes, yes.
And yet no one interrogates that from the inside saying, you know, so what you're telling me is that the only way into heaven is to subjugate a human being and enslave mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. And it always happens to be women mm-hmm. in all these different forms. I mean, what the friggin' hell?
Mm-hmm. Has there ever been a cult, Siobhan, that was led by women and they subjugated men?
I can only think of, and there have probably been some.
Sure.
I can think of one cult in Centralia, Washington, that has been led by a woman. I forget her name, her real name, but she goes by the name Ramtha.
Yeah, and, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and she channels a 30,000-year-old Indian mystic, and she gets up and gives predictions on stage, and she's been covered on TV. Really, my word of the day is wackadoodle. She's a wackadoodle. And I don't know that she subjugates men at all. I think she exploits men. But that was, I had a friend who actually worked in Ramtha's warehouse. Didn't believe in Ramtha, but it was a job out in Centralia, Washington, and she would mail out her books and CDs. And the woman got fabulously rich with this. And anybody, I think she's probably still on YouTube if you Google Ramtha, and you can watch her do her channeling on stage, and she puts on this fake Indian accent, and it's I mean, anybody outside you would think would look at this and go, this is nuts, but she had hundreds of thousands of followers at one point. So
does she fall into the category for you, Siobhan, of being a guru? And if so, what's the difference between a cult leader and a guru?
Guru, I think, is a little, I mean, it can be both. It can certainly be both. And I would say she was more of a cult leader because she had a lot of control over her followers. But a guru can just be, I mean, some people I know that study meditation and they're not crazy and it's not cult-like. But the guru would be the person who sees himself as the teacher, as the leader. It's a term I'm very suspicious of.
I know you are. That's why I asked, because I wasn't quite sure what the definition was. Again, I want to, because when people hear these things, I want to make sure everyone understands what this is. And so,
right. That's a really good question. So I'd say could be a cult leader, but also may just be a meditation teacher who's, you know, a little bit self-elevated.
Just explore it a little if you hear the word.
yeah. Be cautious. I keep away from people who call themselves gurus.
It's like it's just like a chart, you know, it's like a tree. It's like, it's the umbrellas. You start as a motivational speaker. Like, just think, guys, everybody's like a step away from being a guru. And then you can go to guru, and then you're kind of intermingling, you know, you got a little more, you got people that are really into you a little bit much, and then you get to be cult leader. And I guess if you got the right type of personality, it just keeps inviting, well, if people love me this much, they'll love me this much more if I have this kind of power. And if you have a willing group of people and you have the disposition to become that sort of person, and you have enough people telling you, you are gifted. You see things in people that others don't. You hear things. You must have some sort of divine ability. Some people start to believe that. And I wonder if Bateman did exactly that. You know, I think Warren Jeffs did that. I think he totally went down the Kool-Aid trail. But I don't know that all of them, I don't think they all start that way. But again, it's like your own confirmation bias. Enough people start telling you that you have some sort of amazing supernatural ability. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You might start believing it.
Mm-hmm. It's seductive, and certain people with those narcissistic tendencies, they're very quick to slide into that position of power over other people. And then when they get a few followers, and they get women, vulnerable women, and they start having all the sexual exploitation, the financial exploitation that goes with those things. And yeah, I know I'm sure more than one, but a Buddhist guru who was an American guy, but he wrote a few books, gained popularity, and ended up with a lot of financial ripping people off, people selling their homes, giving him money, and sexual exploitation. So
it's almost like, I mean, when I think of a motivational speaker, like one of the most common ones everybody knows, Tony Robbins. Let's throw that out there.
Or me.
You know, or Robin Dreek, by the way. You know, when you think of that, a motivational speaker, and obviously, you know, Tony Robbins has whole programs where, you know, and it's his business. He makes money, you know, on information and motivating people. But he turns it back to the consumer of the information and goes, this is your power. This is everything I'm teaching you. It's on you to do. It's not on getting more information from me. Like, I can help you more if you want, but, you know, and if you subscribe right now, we're going to throw in a free food dehydrator. But if it's far more of a reflection back onto the person. I think that's what changes it quite often in the guru culture. And then when you get into cult leader is that reflection doesn't exist. It's simply, yes, you need me for everything. Not here, take this information, go practice it. Become as good as I am at practicing these things. I think that is a big distinction. Don't you, Robin, like on what that difference is?
Well, and actually Tasha Yurick wrote a great book called Insight about people with self-awareness and the science behind self-awareness. And she had a great term in there I use consistently all the time. And we can assess people on social media like this too. And people, motivational speakers or potential cult leaders or gurus, are you an informer? In other words, you're providing information for the benefit of others, or are you a me-former? Are you just talking about what I can do, what I can do, what I can do, pay attention to me? So, and that's where I think that line gets discerned. It's like you can kind of balance these things out, me-former versus informer. In other words, are you providing information to empower others to solve a critical life challenge in their lives by the information you provided, irrespective of your input towards it? Again, they can ask it, they can seek it. But again, it's about people on their own path, walking their own path, solving their own problems, the ways with methods that they've learned from information you could provide. That's what informers, I think, do.
Mm-hmm. And I'm always, I'm not a Tony Robbins fan. I have friends who are. But I'm always suspicious of people who are selling magic formulas. And here's the formula to wealth. And anybody can do this. There are so many systemic barriers to formulas, people that just can't pull these things off. There are false promises made.
Sure.
And particularly when they are getting mega wealthy over selling their material and seminars. And ethical. I could write a book on the problems I have with Tony Robbins. But,
as I say,
one of my best friends just loves him, and she doesn't. She's never made any money following the things he says, which I think was, you know, one of his big points. And he has a poor history with treating women. So
sure.
And for people like that too, people ask me all the time about, hey, what do you think about so-and-so's work or so-and-so's work? And I said, unless there's someone like Siobhan, licensed clinician and things like that, I say, always use the caveat here, for entertainment purposes only.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, because that's literally what it is. It's for entertainment purposes only. If you get some entertainment out of it, great. But to think more deeply than that is probably not. And then that hopefully answers some of the good comments we're having in the text session as well. It's like, I'm not promoting it either. I'm just saying, hey, take it for a grain of salt.
Yeah.
It's for entertainment only.
Grain of salt, and never give up your critical thinking skills.
100%.
And never elevate people, because, you know, when somebody puts themselves, above everybody else in a hierarchy, I have special knowledge that you don't, and here's what you can pay to get my special knowledge. Red flag, because nobody is a prophet. I'm sorry. I don't believe we have prophets. There are people who have bits of information that may be helpful, but as I always say, always analyze, always ponder, always think about it. And another old saying my mother used to say is, swallow the watermelon, but spit out the seeds. You know,
yeah, it's good.
Something good you can take from it, great, but don't take the BS.
Some people just have more reps than others. And so you can benefit from the reps other people have, you know, that they've learned from, you know, regurgitated, I mean, thought about, and then, you know, learn from and able to share back with the world, like you, Siobhan, and theirs that you've been through as well.
Give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. Siobhan's book that she was talking about and reading from, highly recommended. A very first-person human account of surviving extreme religiosity. Highly recommended, Nightbird, wherever you get books, go and check it out. Bateman got 50 years. The father who gave away his daughters got life. All 11 co-defendants were convicted. The Netflix documentary then ends. But Short Creek doesn't. The FLDS doesn't. Warren Jeffs is reportedly still running the operation from a Texas prison cell. The same theology, the same obedience structure, the same isolation. It's all still there. This conversation is about the questions the doc raises and can't answer. Is any of this actually over? Here to do that, my co-host Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program with the FBI, and Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author of the book Nightbird, available wherever you get books, also a survivor of extreme religiosity and a great resource on this topic, and in another hand that's being held out saying, I've survived this. You can too. I want to pick up where we left off in our last segment. Siobhan, you said never give up critical thinking. And that's such an important thing. Unfortunately, I feel like a lot of reason that people fall into cults is because people don't like critical thinking. It takes work. It takes effort. It takes thought. Sometimes it feels icky. But, you know, it's certainly a key to living a happy, successful, safe life. But again, it's something that not everybody is the greatest at. Okay, now Bateman's gone. Some still believe he's their leader from behind bars, too. But he's gone. That is the problem with communities like this. Warren Jeff's gone. These people, for them, a lot of them, have never practiced critical thinking. They have no reps in it. They have no muscle memory on it. That's what makes them such easy prey and made them such easy prey for a person like Bateman to step in. So how do you implant, how do you teach critical thinking to someone who's in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, or whatever, that has never had this demonstrated in front of them before? The thinking's always been done by the religious leader, and to do so is that's witchcraft. That's an evil sin.
Exactly. It's become an intergenerational way of life and the way of perceiving the world. So it's very intransigent to get through to folks like this. I think the only, well, I can't say for sure, only way, maybe there are other ways, but having someone outside of the group, just as Christine Marie did in the documentary, someone make a heart-to-heart connection that feels safe. I loved the woman Julia in the documentary because she bonded with Christine. She could tell Christine really cared about her, and she started going over and kind of having secret conversations with her about the things that were bothering her. And Christine was one safe person she could talk to. And once she started talking to her, the floodgates opened. And her thinking just, which I think she was a smart woman, and she was really having to suppress a lot to stay in that group and to go along with Moroni, the husband. There's another red flag. Don't marry a man named Moroni. But I think that's probably the way out for so many of them, is having a connection with someone who's non-judgmental, who cares, but makes it safe to have those questions and to have those doubts and to listen and to, you know, sometimes just by opening that door for somebody who's in a cult like this, that can make the difference, rather than coming in, which would probably be my tendency. What the heck are you guys doing? This is all BS, right? Because I'm so out there with what I think. But Christine did a marvelous job of connecting and allowing a safe space for questions. And obviously not everybody bit the hook for that, but that one woman did. And that opened the door for getting enough information to the police and, you know, and busting the whole thing open.
Yeah, it seemed with Julia in the documentary that her love for her children overpowered her love of her religion.
Yes.
Which I found also interesting, because she even said it in the documentary that that it was at odds with her, really, because she really believed in this, and that she's very religious. She very much believed in FLDS. I wonder, would she have had, do you think, the same reaction if she had been part of, what the hell did Warren Jeffs call his place in Texas?
Chuck E. Cheese. No,
it's where he moved everyone to there. I wonder if she would have had the same reaction if Warren Jeffs, you know, plucked her daughter and gave it to him or someone else in that, or if it just happened to be Samuel Bateman that kind of was the red flag for her. I wonder, because she did so devoutly believe in it, but she just couldn't bring herself to hand her daughter over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be good to know. She may have been someone that over time was able to think her own thoughts, and it just took a little bit of validation from Christine to make a movement. But it was still very hard for her because she had the belief of women are under the authority of their husbands, who's under the authority of the prophet, who's under the authority of the Heavenly Father, and their only goal was to obey, obey, obey. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying, you know, that leakage, you could see it started leaking in there somehow, that ability to interrogate information and be curious. You know, both for you, when you started having that same leakage, and for her, what do you think can inspire someone to start thinking? Because that's always the hardest part. What do you, any ideas on for her, but I know even for you?
Yeah, in my case, I had a phase, and I'd say it was 13 through 15, where I really tried to be devout. And that was when I got the idea that I just need to get married, and met the older man at church at 15 and was groomed and married at 16 and started having babies. So I was following the script that I was told. But certainly, I never completely lost my critical thinking. I tried to, because I wanted to be the good Christian wife. I tried to stop thinking. But it was really that the group I was in had such an emphasis on faith healing, and that if you just had faith and you prayed and the congregation prayed, that it would be healed. Anybody would be healed. And I was promised, I actually still have the little pamphlet, I found it recently, Childbirth Without Pain for Christian Women. And when I had my first baby at 16, I went in bragging that I wasn't going to have any pain. And surprise!
How'd that work out for you?
Yeah, after 24 hours of screaming.
And then you blame yourself because you must not have been praying enough.
Well, I caught at that point, there was some insight that somehow this did not all pull together. And then the next thing was my mother's death of cancer. I had been promised she would be healed. And then the little boy in the church with leukemia at age 5, and they promised he would not die. And then when he died, they said he'd be raised from the dead miraculously. None of that happened. And so I had enough of a mind to say, this smells fishy.
Because I remember you called the hotline.
I called the prayer hotline.
I remember that in the book. It was so. She called the prayer hotline, and this chick on the phone prays with you, and you're like, all right, it's all better now. And I'm like, what?
Yeah, your mother's healed. Go tell her to rise up and walk. And she was in a coma. She was brain dead, essentially in a coma. And I went over and I felt silly saying it out loud. But I said it in my mind, because God can read our thoughts, right? So I just went, come on, Mom, raise up and walk. Didn't happen. And so I am just so grateful. I was always a reader, and I was in public school. So I was not isolated, and I was not surrounded by people who had these extreme beliefs. So I'm just so grateful for that.
Is that the key right there? Because I was going to ask, you know, okay, you had these things demonstrated to you that contradicted what you were told of what was going to happen. They're going to rise from the dead. This is going to happen. I mean, there's no history of these things ever happening to anyone, but this is going to happen this time. And then it doesn't happen. And it happens over and over, and promises are made and made, and none of them ever come true in these sort of situations. Mm-hmm. And critical thinkers get the hell out because they go, well, this is a line of crap. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But there's so many that don't. There's so many that just like, oh, well, they were wrong again. But, you know, it's the Lord's will. I mean, what are they? What is keeping people in these sort of isolation chambers? And maybe that is it right there. The isolation chambers of lies, of being let down time and time again, where we say it's going to happen, it's not going to, it doesn't happen. Is isolation the key? That is my question. Yeah. Is isolation the key to keeping that belief system going? Because we see it in so many things, the Duggars, where it's like very insulated. We don't go to public school. We don't interact with society. We don't have jobs. We have our own businesses. Like everything is so isolated. So no information can come in that may say, "Woo, you might be wrong about this, Jim Bob." Right. And if you keep everybody together and nobody questions any of that, then I guess you kind of keep it. But eventually it cracks. We're in a world where it's insanely difficult to not have other information come in unless you're really like this, like Bateman in the middle of the desert. I mean, that's the ultimate isolation. Is it that? Is it the isolation that keeps people faithful even when the promises fail?
Yeah. When people are surrounded by the dogma and the false beliefs and the thinking errors, and this is all they hear, and they believe that their eternal salvation depends on not asking questions. I do see a lot of people come to therapy after they've left groups like this, not always that high controlled, but they've left groups where you know, they had been coerced and told to believe crazy things and give all their money. A lot of people do leave, and a lot of people are writing books about it now because they're coming out and discussing it. I didn't discuss my history with religion for 50 years, really, because I was embarrassed about it. Yeah. And I just got to an age where, you know, we're seeing so much of this, people are coming out and talking about it, and it's time. And, you know, I am a human being. I have made terrible mistakes in my life. There were reasons for it. And if other people can learn from my story and gain some sense of freedom and autonomy and develop into their better selves, then if I do even one person good, it's worth talking about it. So I'm too old to care about shame anymore. It is what it is.
Siobhan, what's the first, I'm sorry, Tony.
Go ahead.
Siobhan, when someone, you mentioned, you know, when they're first rescued, when they first come out, as a therapist, what's the first thing you begin working on with them? What's the hardest, what's the first baby step that they'll take after, all right, I'm out, I recognize it, or they were pulled out, saved, whatever it is, that you as a therapist start working on to start reacclimating them to, and man, I wrote this one down, to get them to start thinking again because they tried to not think for so long.
Yeah. Usually if they're open to coming to a therapist, they're thinking. You know, they've started. They're trying to make sense of it. They've got a lot of trauma to talk through. And I just really encourage them to feel their feelings because that's one of these things these groups do is they repress. They teach you to repress. And you're supposed to be joyful all the time. And you're supposed to always smile and tell the world, I love everybody. You know, there's just this script that they've been taught to follow. It's not real. And by the time they come to therapy, they're realizing that they've been sold a bill of goods. And so I just want them to start being honest. Often it's helpful to keep a journal, do writing. Your feelings are valid. Your feelings are there for a reason. Let's help you feel what they are. And then the questions come, and then we can sort through the questions. And as they start to feel their real feelings and talk about their history and talk about, you know, we can talk about what was good about this experience, what was not so good about this experience. And usually there's a long laundry list about what was not so good about it. And because of my background, I can understand that. I never want to make them feel stupid, you know, because people can easily get sucked into this stuff.
You're such a gift. Thank you.
So
that time period where you didn't talk about your religious trauma and everything, we're talking about, you know, obviously a different time period. And I think things have changed. We're in a society now where people can be far more open about their religious trauma and experiences, but we still do have a stigma to it from people who are not necessarily in a cult. But I mean, for example, folks who belong to the local Catholic church, folks who are at the Lutheran church, folks who are at the ones that are not necessarily considered cults per se, folks who are just, you know, everyday, you know, Christian religious type folks. You bring up something like the Duggars. You bring up something like your experiences. And they have very little information and understanding of a lot of extreme religious behavior. But the first thing that comes out of their mouth when you bring up some sort of religious trauma is they don't want to judge it. They don't want to even talk about it because, oh, well, that's God's, you know, they immediately go to offense. And and so many people do. They go to offense and defend God, and because they take even just this, the inclination that somebody could be abusing the word of God as like, oh, that's impossible, even though the Bible talks about it all over the place of like, there's going to be people that bastardize this, everybody, look out for it. And then when people are like, hey, here's something to look out for. Oh, no, that couldn't be possible because they have a cross on their neck. It's like, yeah, that's a red flag right there for some folks. How much of that, how much of the societal unacceptance of hearing you out, hearing your story, held you back from sharing your story just because it's exhausting to have to re-explain the details of what you went through to people who just don't, they don't even want to hear it because it challenges or it might challenge their way of thinking. That to me is an interesting aspect to all of this.
Yeah, and I think you're hitting the nail on the head. It's important to emphasize that not all Christian groups are cults. Not all Buddhist groups are cults. It's a very distinct type of organization. It's a closed system. And the key thing for me is, does your faith make your life better? Does it help you? Does it comfort you? Does it help you grow? Or is it shutting you down and causing psychological harm? And there's a distinct difference in those groups. And there are these fringe, closed off from society, us versus them, everybody else has it wrong and is going to hell. And then there are churches that do wonderful work and people that are devout Christians, but they really do try to model their lives after Jesus, you know, who was a very loving figure. And so I don't ever want people to feel like I'm knocking their faith, and I try very hard never to do that with clients, but there are very different ways of being a person of faith and very different ways that churches manifest.
It's funny. I keep going back to the behaviors of trust that I'm always trying to exhibit, and I'm always looking for others, both individually as well as groups, whether it's a religious group or an organization that is open, honest communication. Transparency, and vulnerability. Vulnerability means you own up to a mistake, a transgression, and you have a self-correcting thing in place to get better, overcome it, acknowledge it, and grow. And so if those three pillars are in place, it's most likely a place where you can have a healthy engagement, whatever it's political or religious or anything like that, because to your point, Siobhan, if it brings joy, happiness, and healthy relationships, it's a good thing for our lives.
Good
and again,
thing.
Transparency, 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 transparency. If there's any aspect of what you're part of or a group you're part of that says you can't share, that's a massive red flag.
1,000% Wonderful conversation, as always, everybody. Siobhan's book, Nightbird, available wherever you get books. Go check it out. Amazing survival story here. And Robin's latest book, available as well, It's Not All About Me, also available wherever books are sold. Go and check them out. All right, your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. The links are in the description. Until next time, for Robin, Siobhan, and Todd, I am Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.